The summertime chorus of insects in the afternoon and evening is going strong, but it's also time to start thinking about fall and keeping out tiny home invaders. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here today. We'll talk about the katydids and crickets that sing Iowans to sleep this time of year, how to prepare for the annual fall invasion of insects as the days grow short, and find out where all the mosquitoes have gone. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran will be with us shortly, but we're going to start the hour with insects and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to talk first about some insects that we're not seeing a whole lot of. And one of those is mosquitoes. We haven't seen a lot recently, although with all the water we had for a while, it sure seemed like we were going to be overrun.
And very briefly, we were overrun with mosquitoes that we call floodwater mosquitoes. These are the ones that we frequently see earlier in the summer. They reproduce in temporary water impoundments. So when we have a flood, we think of all that flood water that's rolling by in the river or in the expanded river. And it's not the moving flood water that leads to mosquito outbreaks. It's when the floods recede and water is trapped in these temporary impoundments, whether it's depressions or potholes or even your bird bath or your plugged rain gutters, all those kinds of things. That is where those mosquitoes breed, the ones we call floodwater mosquitoes. And we had a lot of those back in late May and June, but then the rain stopped. And we had that period of about 2 to 3 weeks without much rainfall. The temporary impoundments dried up. Mosquitoes stopped breeding. They stopped reproducing. And the population crashed fairly quickly. So it was a good summer for mosquitoes for a little while, but now it's a good summer for people.
Well, especially now that we had, in the Iowa City area, we had 3 different gnat infestations, and finally we're gnat-free.
That's right.
As well. So it is lovely to go outside right now. With the rain that we've had, particularly in central Iowa, though, in the last week or two, will we see another spike, do you think?
We'll have mosquitoes throughout the rest of the year. We never quite get rid of them, and we actually change the composition of the mosquito species that are out there. And right now, we're getting into sort of the fall mosquitoes that we usually have. Unfortunately, this is also the time of the year when the mosquitoes that are more likely to transmit West Nile virus are out. So we'll never be completely out of them, but because of the spacing of the rainfalls we usually get at this time of the year, the mosquito populations will stay, but they won't really explode like they did earlier in the year.
Now, another insect that we haven't seen a lot of this summer is the Japanese beetle. Is that anecdotal or is that across the state? Are we seeing far fewer?
It's across the Midwest that
we're having
a lot fewer Japanese beetles. And part of it is the cycle of life, especially with an invasive insect. You go through some times when you don't have them, and then you have a few, and the population explodes, and the population usually moderates after that. So some of us were at that point where the populations were moderating on their own. But last year's double whammy seems to have really been hard on the Japanese beetles. And the double whammy is that it was dry in the late summer and fall last year when the female beetles were laying their eggs and the grubs were establishing in the ground. So they were stressed and unhealthy because of the dryness in the fall. And then the prolonged, extra lengthy period of cold, freezing temperatures in the soil finished them off. So the combination of drought and too cold for too long seems to have reduced the Japanese beetle population down to a mere handful, where just a year ago, people were collecting buckets full.
Right. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that they won't be back.
they will bounce back. Maybe not to where they were before, and it may take a few years, and it will take some good weather, some good moisture in the fall of the year. But insects have a remarkable ability to rebound and recoup, and eventually they will do it. But maybe the worst of it is over for most of us, and at least we can hope so.
With these invasive species, do they tend to moderate over time and become a more sustainable, less annoying part of our ecosystem?
I think so. And especially if you go back and look at what happened in Ohio, New Jersey, the Atlantic seaboard, where the Japanese beetle has been present since 1916, they weren't having the huge outbreaks that we were because Japanese beetle was still new to us. So eventually the biological controls and other factors begin to moderate the population, and it's not always as bad as it is at its peak. They can come back, they can return, they can be bad again, but they won't be as bad as they are at the worst that we have seen here in much of Iowa for the last few years.
All right, so now we can stop talking about Japanese beetles and just focus on the emerald ash borer.
That's right. Which, speaking of invasive species, we're up to 12 counties where this new insect, fairly new to us, has been found. Been in the United States since about 2002, been documented since 2002, probably been here longer than that. And I believe it's like 23 different states in the United States now have emerald ash borer. It's from New England to Colorado. It's from Wisconsin to Georgia, Minnesota to Georgia. So it has quickly covered a large portion of the United States as well.
All right. So it was not as averse to the dry fall and the polar vortex as the Japanese beetles were.
Exactly. And that's one where we talked last year about, oh, maybe the insects that are in these tree trunks will freeze to death.
Because we were all hoping.
Yeah, that was just wishful thinking. They did quite well. And other things that you would think, gee, you know, katydid eggs are on the twigs all winter long up there in the wind and the snow and the rain and the sleet. And yet the katydid population in my backyard and in the city park near me is bigger and louder than it's ever been. So does winter affect insects? The answer is it depends. Some insects were hurt by the past winter. Others seem to have no effect at all.
Well, let's talk about those katydids, because I know, of course, we had our big cicada emergence earlier in the summer. We talked about cicadas a lot. Of course, now the cicadas that we hear every year are out. They're singing in the afternoon. Then we have the katydids at night. And we also seem to have a lot of crickets this year.
It's a good year for lots of different species of crickets. When people think of crickets, the one they normally think of is the black field cricket. It's about 3/4 of an inch long, black. It's the one where a solitary male gets into your house, makes his little chirping sound by rubbing his wings together, and drives you nuts and keeps you awake at night. There is that kind of cricket, but there are dozens of other species of crickets that we hear out there. Sometimes it's a little hard to isolate which insect you're hearing, because there is this cacophony, there is this chorus going on around you that sort of envelops you when you're out there in the evening listening. And it's a little hard to separate them out, but when you listen for the higher pitched trills in the background, those are frequently some of these other kinds of crickets.
I think a lot of us tend to think about katydids and cicadas in the same breath. But just run down for us again how we know what we're hearing.
Well, there are websites online where you can listen to insect songs and you can take your recording out and listen. But cicadas are more closely related to aphids. And we have two kinds of cicadas. We went through the periodical cicadas earlier in the year. Those are gone. We now have the annual cicadas, the ones that appear annually, the ones that appear every year in the second half of the summer. And we have a couple, three different species of those even. And the one that I hear more often in my backyard, and this will vary with where you are, is a cicada that has the interesting name of scissor grinder cicada. Now, you have to be an old-fashioned person to remember that we used to sharpen scissors on a grindstone by putting the scissors against the grinding wheel with sort of a repetitive motion that created a zzz, zzz, zzz sound, and that one's called the scissor grinder. We also have the dog day cicada, which is just a high-pitched trill, which is more steady, a zzz, very high-pitched sound. So those are the cicadas that we hear in late afternoon till just at dusk. When they quit, the katydids start up, and katydids are related to grasshoppers and crickets, and katydids sing by rubbing their wings together. And it sounds like the name of the insect. When you hear them, what the sound you hear is katydid-did, katydid-did, zit-zit-zit, zit-zit-zit, and that's as the wings are passing over each other, scratching to make that noise with the special structures they have. And the males are very good at making that noise. They have a hollow abdomen that amplifies the noise. They hold their wings up like a megaphone, and it's quite loud when you're out, 9, 10 o'clock at night in a wooded area that has katydids. Not everybody gets them. That's kind of an interesting thing, how spotty they are. They're in the north half of Ames, but they're not in the south half. So not everybody gets to hear these, but it's worth a trip to hear the differences.
And we are enjoying this beautiful late summer, but it is time to think a little bit about the fall. And the fall is the time when we get a lot of questions about insects coming into our homes, particularly box elder bugs, ladybugs. So what should we be thinking about right now with those little ones?
Now is the time to weather strip, to seal up cracks and gaps, to close up the house as tightly as you can, recognizing that you could spend all day looking for cracks and gaps between the foundation and the siding, around the windows, around the doors, but insects are going to be more persistent than you are, and if there are any cracks or gaps, they will find them even if you didn't. But now, while it's still nice out, is the time to be doing our weather stripping and sealing up our cracks and gaps. It doesn't feel to me like it's going to be a big year for box elder bugs and lady beetles. We're certainly not going to have the lady beetle populations, the multicolored Asian lady beetle populations that we had back in the 2006 to 2008 period. It's not going to be like that, but it could still happen. But it's not been that kind of a summer because we haven't had those huge aphid populations earlier in the season for the lady beetle populations to develop. I'm seeing box elder bugs, but I don't think it's going to be the outbreaks we've had in the past. But the other invaders, everything from spiders to crickets, they will get in if they can. So now's the time to seal them out.
All right, and get the vacuum cleaner ready as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, get it ready. Get it. Get a fresh bag
get it
in there.
Serviced.
So you can suck up the box elder bugs as they appear on your windowsill.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me today, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will join us. He and Donald will answer your questions about your garden, your lawn, your landscape, and your insects you encounter. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is also here now. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we have a lot of questions already on email, but you can join us with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. And we'll start with an email question. This is from Shannon in Centerpoint. She said, I'm in the process of curing shallots on the screen porch. Will this high humidity interfere? I don't know if that's in your area of expertise, Richard, but what do you think?
Well, you would like something that's a little bit drier as far as the air temperature. I don't think they're going to spoil it. It may just take longer for them to dry.
All right. And she also says that I'm starting new grass. It's sprouted well. Mm-hmm. It's been growing 2 weeks. How long do I continue watering it?
Well, basically what you want to do is once it comes up, you want to water less frequently, but deeper. So you might skip a day or two and then water, and then maybe skip 2 or 3 days and water. And I would say once you've mowed it maybe once or twice, then once a week should be sufficient.
All right. And now let's get to the phones. And Lori is on the line in Columbus Junction. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is kind of strange, but I have fleas in my house. My animals never go outside. I have bombed the house, and I still have fleas. Do you have any suggestions?
This is a common question, and we went through almost a decade to a decade and a half of no flea questions. Nobody ever asked fleas. But now, this year, you're not alone. Fleas seem to have rebounded, and we're getting more calls this summer than we did in the last 5 years combined. Fleas are on lots of different animals, and one of the big carriers in the urban environment are raccoons. And so you don't have to have your cats and dogs go outside. The raccoons could come up and sit on your back porch and scratch their ears, and fleas would infest you that way. Bombs don't really work very well because they just treat the exposed surfaces. And oftentimes we have to use an insecticide that we direct to the location where the fleas are the most numerous. Now, you may think they're everywhere, but if you stop and think about it, there's going to be these hot spots where there are more fleas than others, and it's likely to be where the pets spend most of their time. Direct sprays there. Of course, the spot-on or the topical treatments for control of fleas. And number three is vacuum, vacuum, vacuum. It's just amazing how much mechanical control we can get by sucking up fleas and then either discarding the vacuum cleaner bag or freezing it to use it over something like that. But you're not alone. There are no miracles. There are no easy solutions. And it takes this combined approach of all the things that we can think of to do.
All right. Thank you so much.
Now, thanks a lot for your call, Lori. And Donald, I was wondering, when you said it's been about 10 years, I mean, that seems to coincide with the incredible popularity of those spot treatments.
I think so, too. And I don't know if we've gotten lazier about using the topical applications of flea and tick treatments of our pets, or if something else has happened. If I don't believe the fleas have changed. I don't think the insecticides have changed. But it's just kind of remarkable how almost nationwide, as we look at the literature of pest control and as we hear from other pest control companies around the country, that they are talking again about doing flea treatments when we went for that decade and pest control companies had almost no flea treatment business. They spent all their time treating bed bugs instead.
Huh, very interesting. Next up is Bob in Des Moines. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of gardening questions. One, I have a Genovese basil that I've raised for 15, 20 years. Always come up nice and healthy. This year, came up to 15 inches, looked real good, and all of a sudden it started turning black. Started black at the end of the leaves and looks like it's progressing on toward the stem. Do you have any idea of what that is happening?
Not off idea as far as at this time. I would probably suggest maybe sending a sample into Iowa State, maybe to the Plant Diagnostic Clinic, and see if we can see something there. I would suspect probably a disease of some type. We had a wet spring and summer, and probably it might be some type of foliar disease.
Let me ask one other thing about peppers. I've had an Italian heirloom pepper for 50 years with no problems, and this year it's doing terrible, and I'm hearing that from my neighbors. Is there something generic to peppers this year?
Now, when you say terrible, meaning what? Is it not producing?
It bloomed a little early, and it hasn't bloomed since, and the blooms that do set on don't set on.
Right. The problem there basically is the weather. We've had some very cool nights, and when you have very cool nighttime temperatures, that tends to interfere with flower development and pollination. And so they're just not blooming very well, and when they do, we're not getting very good pollination. So the end result is they're not producing much in the way of fruit.
All right, so just a kind of a bummer of a year.
Yeah, for peppers.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for your call. Pardon me. Let's go back to an email question. This is from Ronald in Iowa City. I live in Iowa City with a small backyard covered by a large pin oak and other trees. I've tried to plant deep shade grass to no avail, and the planted vinca is spotty. I'd accept any ground cover you recommend, clover, anything. Please advise.
Well, you can try some of the grasses, things like creeping red fescue, hard fescue, chewing fescue. Those are the most shade-tolerant grass. If they don't survive, then you have to look at ground covers. I guess one option would be you could plant a number of native woodland plants, wildflowers, like woodland phlox, wild ginger, Solomon seal. You could go that route, and that would be very nice, very pretty. The other approach might be a large area of hostas or something of that nature, some type of fairly aggressive ground cover, like maybe lily of the valley or creeping lily turf. Those would be options.
All right. And we seem to have a couple of emotionally charged emails. Ronald sounds pretty desperate, and Nikki in Dubuque sounds annoyed. She says, "We have a spider plant that is outside right now, and I know my boyfriend is going to want to bring that thing in come winter. How can we treat it beforehand to reduce the number of bugs, gnats that may be living in the soil?"
Oh, take it in the shower with you and spray it down with soapy water.
I think he needs to take it in the shower with him.
I was going to say, I didn't know we were into relationship advice as well. You know, who do you like more, the spider plant or the boyfriend? It could come to that. Soapy water, and especially insecticidal soap, you know, we used to blithely recommend that you just take the dishwashing liquid from under your kitchen sink and mix it up at a tablespoon per quart of water and spray your plants. And when they changed dishwashing detergents to be ultra, when they changed them to be high grease cutting, when they added perfumes, when they added surfactants, when they upped the dose of all the other things that are in there besides just detergent, we ran into a problem that those detergents will now kill the plant. So just to be safe, if we buy insecticidal soap at the garden center and mix it up according to label directions, we can spray that thoroughly on the top, bottom, left, right, underside, top side of the leaves and every stem, and it will kill the soft insects that are there. And mostly we're looking to kill things like spider mites and scale insects, maybe white flies, maybe aphids and so forth. But that's probably the best we've got. And then finally, just to kind of clean it up, if you hang it in the shower and rinse all that soap away, you've done as well as you can. And then you just keep a close eye on it to see if you have to do it again.
All right. And she also has a follow-up. She says, "How should a spider plant be planted and maintained? How much light, water, et cetera? I don't feel like it looks as healthy as it could be."
Well, I would give it bright light. It doesn't need direct sun, but it should be near a window where it gets bright light. Fairly easy to maintain. I would say water the plant well when the soil surface gets dry to the touch. I would not fertilize during the winter months. So mainly just kind of maintain it. If you need to, you can pot up some of the offspring.
Well, and if it's not looking good, can she cut it back?
I don't think I would do that. They could cut off any leaves that are kind of turning brown. If the whole plant is looking kind of sad, the option would be to go ahead and remove some of the offsets or baby plants and pot those up and go from there.
All right. Start fresh.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got a few lines open for your call right now. And again, the number 866-780-9100. Jennifer is on the line next in West Des Moines. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
I have two little boys, and I try to keep toxins and things out of my home as much as possible. But I have weeds in my yard and grubs, and I'm wondering if there is a safe way to get rid of them where my kids can play in the backyard and I don't need to worry.
Well, let me take the grub question first. You can live with grubs. You can lose a little bit of turf grass to grub damage every once in a while, which gives you then a chance to replant, resod, reinvigorate the lawn. So grub control is one of those that I think of as pretty optional. But if you insist on having a lawn that looks as good as the golf course, then yes, you will spend a lot on herbicides and insecticides, including grub treatments. The grub treatments we use needed to have been done by August 15th as a prevention. If you have grubs now, you could use a rescue treatment, something like Dilox insecticide. But grub treatments only work if you water them in. So you put the insecticide on the ground, you turn on the sprinkling system, and you irrigate for at least half an inch of water. That puts the insecticide in the ground where we have two advantages. One, it's down in the ground where the grubs live and will control them better. Number two, it's down in the ground and not on the surface where the kids and the pets are playing. So from a grub treatment point of view, you've got some options there, but grub treatments are usually not the risk or the threat that we think they might be, because if you've done it right, you irrigated them in. Weed control, Richard?
As far as weed control, you basically have two options. One would be to remove them physically by hand, dig them up. The other option would be to use a herbicide. And you have a number of weeds. The biggest category would be the broadleaf weeds, things like dandelions, plantain, clover. And to minimize the use, I would put it on at the right time. And that's basically fall, sometime between, let's say, late September and early November. I would tend to use a product that has two or three compounds in it, because they control a wider range of the broadleaf weeds, and you should get very good control. In the spring, you could put on corn gluten meal, which is a pre-emergent. It's a natural product, and that should prevent crabgrass from coming up in the spring.
And we're required by our employers to always mention, read and follow label directions. And part of those directions will tell you how long people, pets, kids, wildlife should stay off of the area after it's treated. Those instructions for how long you have to wait were written and approved by the manufacturer's lawyers. Think about that. Lawyers are protecting the manufacturer by telling you how long to stay off. And if they're comfortable telling you to stay off till it's dry, they feel there's very little risk to their company if you follow those instructions. So that's the minimum that you would do, and you could extend that out for however long it makes you feel good, but read and follow label directions.
All right, Jennifer, thanks a lot for your call. And I thought this summer in particular that it'd be nice if somebody ran a summer camp for kids that teaches them how to identify and pull weeds. I would send my children to that.
There's an art to that. There is.
Yeah.
You know, some plants have this deep root system that you have to be very careful as far as digging or pulling. Others, you can just pull right up, and it's amazing there's a difference there.
Well, so. Richard, it sounds like you are a candidate for starting this summer camp.
And some things that are easy to pull up, like Creeping Charlie, it could be your hobby because it keeps breaking off. I pull up, I get about a foot.
That's difficult to pull, yes.
A foot to 18 inches of it, and I've got it all, and nope, it breaks off.
Yep.
All right, Shirley's on the line next in Grimes. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. I have a question about white flies. I have two bushes just outside the deck that are full. It's full.
Okay.
Lots of white flies. And at night, they're flying around if I have a light on. I bought the product 8 as recommended, and then read the label, and it's so toxic to birds and everything else. So I was wondering how much damage the white fly is to have out there.
I'm not really convinced we are using the right word here for what we're seeing. White flies are little tiny insects about an eighth of an inch long that you see when you brush against the plant. Yeah. And they fly off and then they quickly land. I don't think of them being out at night, but
With a light on, they wouldn't come?
I don't know. They don't seem to be as attracted to lights as I think of. So we may have to keep thinking about, have we named this one correctly? And we'll figure that out some other day. The Insecticide 8 is the new low toxicity product. So we've come through generations of insecticides that were so much more toxic that we now have these things that have very low toxicity. We use them at very low rates. There'll be less than a percent of insecticide in the solution that you apply. And it's a very low toxicity product applied at very low rates, but yet they still put on there that if you screw up and spray a plant in bloom, you can harm pollinators. If you screw up and spray bird nests, you could hurt birds. But compared to what we used just 20, 30 years ago, these are the low toxicity alternatives. So where we have to do it, we would apply according to label directions. We would apply the least amount we could, and we would aim the treatment at where it's going to do the most good. And if they are whiteflies, the treatment needs to be on the underside of the leaves. So that's where we would try to make our application. So all of these things kind of mix together that, yeah, we need to be careful. It's not going to be a huge risk to apply this for the treatment. But your earlier question, will the white flies kill the bush? No, but winter will kill them. So maybe we can balance all this out by saying, we're late enough in the season. Let's just wait and see what happens.
All right, Shirley, thank you so much for your call. And here's a question maybe we can slip in right before the end, or before we get to the break. This is from Marietta. She says, I have about 10 daylilies in a row in my front yard. They're looking pretty tatty right now, and I wondered if it would be okay to mow them down and cover them with mulch.
You could clean them up. You can cut them back, but I wouldn't cover them with mulch. You can put mulch around them, but don't actually cover them with mulch.
Okay, so if she cuts off the flowers? I mean, is that going to...
Cutting off the flowers is perfectly fine. If the foliage is green, leave it. But if the foliage is kind of ratty and turning yellow or brown, they can cut that too.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more of your questions in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here, along with ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. They are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up, Charles in Des Moines. Hi, Charles.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we recently moved, and our lawn seems to be infested with teeny tiny crickets. There are thousands of them, and I don't want them in my house.
Well, I don't think you have to worry about these as much as you do the big crickets. When you look at these teeny tiny crickets, do they appear like they've got wings, like they're fully grown? Do you ever look that closely at them?
I haven't seen any of them fly, so I don't know about wings.
Okay. Well, there's a group of very small, teeny tiny crickets that live on the ground. Entomologists work long and hard to come up with names for insects, and those little tiny crickets that we found on the ground, we call ground crickets.
It's extremely
and
creative.
Brilliant.
Extremely creative. You know, we stay up nights coming up with names. And what do we call the crickets that we find in the field? Those we call the field crickets. So, and those are the big ones. The big black ones that invade people's houses are called the field crickets. These little tiny ones that you just kind of see under the streetlights, you see them on the sidewalk, you see them in the yard, those are called the ones that we call ground crickets.
Okay, but my yard is teeming with them.
Yeah, and some of them may walk in by accident, but it's not going to be the huge invasion that we sometimes get with some other insects. This would be one where, you know, I'd be tempted to try something as soft as possible to see if I could beat back the population. So I might spray them with that insecticidal soap that we've talked about spraying houseplants and other for control of soft-bodied insects. Insecticidal soap is non-toxic. It's just a detergent. You mix it up with water according to label directions. It only kills what it hits. So as the crickets are jumping away, as you're taking your steps, those that jumped away are going to be unaffected, but those slower ones would be killed by that. The earlier caller was had an insecticide called 8, spelled just like the number, EIGHT. That's an insecticide that has broad-spectrum activity, useful for lawns and gardens and other places. You could spray that one. But notice I keep talking about sprays. I think a liquid spray is what it's going to take to beat back the population if you choose to go that route. And you've got other choices at the garden center. I've mentioned two that seem the most logical. But you've got others.
If he just decides to live with the crickets in his yard, how long will they be there?
Till it freezes. And then the population will start to decline before that. But when we get our first really good hard frost, That's when we'll notice a severe decline in the population, but they won't be gone until it's gotten good and frozen. If he does decide to live with them, I predict that in about the middle of November, he'll call us back and tell me I was wrong.
Okay. And so, Charles, you can put that on your calendar. But I also have to ask you, because one of the producers of Talk of Iowa is dealing with a field cricket infestation in her home. What do you do if you have a bunch of field crickets in your house?
Well, seal up cracks and gaps. They have to come in somewhere. They can't be teleported across the foundation. There has to be a gap large enough for them to walk through. So number one, seal up gaps and cracks. And of course, people always tell, well, that's such an impossibility because of the way their house was built or when it was built. But do the best you can. Number two, I'm not a big fan of spraying the outside of my foundation for these kinds of insects, but that's a standard operating procedure, is to take the insecticides like 7 or 8, like the one we've talked about, spray the foundation, spray 3 to 5 feet of the ground next to the foundation to try to create this barrier that keeps them out. Once they're in, your vacuum cleaner, your tissue, or your brief spray of a flying insect aerosol insecticide is going to be the most effective for those that are already inside. Spraying the entire house inside for the occasional cricket is not a good choice. But if we can direct a brief spray at the offender, we'll get them that way.
Okay. And if Charles doesn't choose to spray this late summer or this fall, will he have a lawn covered in crickets next year?
Well, no. Every year is different. And we could think to the recent story of the Japanese beetle, that we had these huge populations just a year ago, and now we don't. We think last year during the drought, we didn't have very many mosquitoes. And by May and June of this year, we had a population explosion. So the populations vary for a lot of different factors, and not just because we had them in the past. And ground cricket is an interesting one that some years I notice a lot of them and some years I don't. So, no, I think this one's highly variable. There's no way to predict what will happen next year based on this year's population.
All right. Speaking of abundant insects, Kyle is on the line at Clear Lake. Hello, Kyle.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is can you tell me why there is just a huge population of dragonflies in my backyard? We do have a little pond and a little, like, marshy area off to the side, but me and my daughter were just running through them last night, and she was just laughing, having a good old time. I'm just curious what the reason for the abundance and population of them is.
All right, Kyle, and I have to echo, Kyle, we've seen dragonfly swarms at my house this year, too, and other people have been commenting on it, but we don't have any water. So mm-hmm. what's the deal with dragonfly swarms?
You're all just incredibly lucky, and you're luckier than I am, because I haven't seen one of these now for going on, 15, 20 years, where the air is just full of them, full of dragonflies, and they're quite mobile. These large dragonflies have come from an aquatic ecosystem. They've come from a river or stream or a pond or a lake somewhere. And we do get these huge feeding frenzy swarms, especially in late evening. And mostly what I've observed in the past is they are feeding on ant swarmers. These are ants that are coming up out of the ground that have wings. They're taking off to fly up in the air for the males and females to find each other and to start new colonies. And along comes a flying buzzsaw of a dragonfly with his or her legs held under the face, and they swoop these flying insects out of the air and eat them whole, eat them alive. Dragonflies are great predators. This is a fantastic story because they are fun. Dragonflies can't hurt us. They can't bite. They don't sting. They're beneficial because they eat insects. And the part that I also want to emphasize from, I think of Clear Lake, I think of the Iowa River, I think of the Mississippi River, dragonflies prosper when the water quality is high. So we've got good water quality somewhere that is producing these abundant numbers of dragonflies. These are all good signs. We all should be as lucky as Kyle and Charity to get out and see these dragonfly swarms in the evening.
Well, and we had a fun layering as well, because we had the dragonflies and then we had the barn swallows. So the dragonflies were feeding, the barn swallows were feeding, and we have a lot of bats too. So I'm sure they got in on the act a little bit later on.
And you wonder who's left to fly to feed them. You know, that if they're swooping mosquitoes and ants out of the air, what's left? Well, there are plenty. There's plenty to go around. There's enough
Absolutely.
For everybody.
All right, Kyle, thank you so much for your call. And next up, we've got Steve on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Charity.
What's
Don
your question?
And Richard, thanks for taking my call. Briefly, I have some arbors that I've lost over the years to bag bugs. Some of them are very tall, and I've got a difficult time in prevention and management, bagworms or bag bugs, whatever the characterization is.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could give me some advice. It seems like some years I've been able to successfully abort any infestations. Other years I've only noticed that they're there by the typical browning, and I've lost some despite my best efforts. But as these get large, it's hard for me to climb a ladder and try and pick the pupae or the bags off. I'm wondering if you have any insight or awareness and what I can do to try and save these, because most of the time, I'm intrigued at how quickly the arbor can succumb to an infestation.
Yeah. Arborvitae is one of the favorite foods of the bagworm. Bagworm is a caterpillar where each caterpillar makes a little sack that it carries around with it as it feeds and grows, and they can be quite destructive. Now, added to that is the fact that a couple of years ago, we had temperatures that were so high that it stressed the arborvitae plants. We've had bad growing conditions with wet springs and dry summers that have stressed the arborvitae. So I'm not anxious to give all the blame to the bagworms. Now, the bagworm defoliates. If the needles are still there but brown, that was something else, because the bagworm actually eats the needles, and you should see these huge bare spots. Bagworms are a southern insect. They don't do well with our cold winters. We should have fewer of them in the state this year than we've had in the recent past because of the winter we just went through. But at the end of June, it's time to start looking at bagworm, looking at arborvitae and spruce. And if the little tiny bagworms are there, that's the time to spray. We can use our Bacillus thuringiensis spray and do a very good job early in the season. If you've waited until the middle or the end of August, you've probably missed the vulnerable stage, and we'll go back to hand picking like you've described.
Thank you very much.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Jim is on the line in Maynard. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I live in Northeast Iowa, and I know that there's been a lot of talk about the emerald ash borer, mm-hmm. but it's in the county next to us. But I have two ash trees in my yard, sort of side by side. They're about 30 years old, and they've been losing the leaves for the last month and a half or so, and what is left there is just the stem of the leaf, and we've taken pictures and tried to send them in. I wondered if it was the adult emerald ash borer feeding on the leaves now, and then maybe, you know, the larva would get into the tree. But we haven't been able. We finally got up and pulled some branches down, and we took a bunch of leaves off. And what we could see was that it was a small bug that's an eighth to 3/16 of an inch long. Mm-hmm. You know, pretty small, and it's kind of orangish red. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of little ones crawling around there too.
Okay.
We don't know what it is.
Nothing you've described yet sounds like emerald ash borer. That's the good
exactly.
news out of this. When you said the leaves were falling, they're actually dropping off whole?
No, they're not. They're what is left is just the vein of the leaf.
Okay. My guess
it's
is...
it's traveled from branch to branch, and now it's heading over to the other tree.
Yeah. I think you've got a long series of potential problems here. Ash sawfly is a small larva that feeds on the leaves of ash trees and does what you say. It eats it down mm-hmm. to the midrib, and so there could have been a generation of those earlier. The small orange insect sounds like the ash spider mite, which we don't think does much damage, but they sure seem to be abundant on ash trees, especially in northeast Iowa in the fall of the year, to the point that ash trees will look orange from a distance, and they'll mm-hmm. be covered with webbing almost like they were wrapped in cellophane. So we see that as well on those.
And this is only on the ash trees, and mm-hmm. and I live in the town, but and just outside of town in several places, I've seen exactly the same thing on these trees. So, yeah, it's they'll start on a branch, and there may be several leaves that are left, but some of the stems and the leaves, they'll just all they'll have is just the vein left.
Mm-hmm. Ash sawfly and other defoliators are stressful, but not fatal.
Okay.
So,
and I can't maybe I can't see the sawfly then. You know, I looked down the leaf, but I didn't see anything that looked like that. But maybe that's a bug that I'm not able to identify. But just
more likely, it was there and gone before you looked. That I think that's one of the characteristics. So we'll keep working with the photos if you want to keep trying that route and look at different times of the year. It's going to be a difficult decision for a lot of people who are looking at these huge old ash trees. It has to be a very healthy tree. It has to be vigorously growing with a full canopy to justify the insecticide treatment. For budgeting purposes, you stand and hug the tree and measure the diameter. Okay, measure the diameter where you hug it and count on about $10 per diameter inch to treat that tree every other year. If you do decide to protect it against emerald ash borer, it can run you $200 every other year for a 20-inch tree, $360 every other year for a 36-inch ash tree. So it's not going to be outrageous, but the insecticides work very well when they are applied in the springtime as an injection. And on those larger trees, that's what we're going to have to decide to do to protect against emerald ash borer. In the meantime, we'll keep looking for these other problems to make sure we keep the ash trees as healthy as possible so we can enjoy them as long as possible.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your call. Carol is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a Roma tomato plant that is being really weird. You know, the tips of a Roma tomato sort of, you know, they have that nice little point at the end.
Right.
Well, this tomato plant, it seems otherwise healthy. It's producing a lot of red tomatoes. But just at the point of maturity, the tips get this brown stub on the end, and it starts rotting from that end.
Right.
And I'm not sure what's going on with it.
Well, it sounds like blossom end rot, which is fairly common on quite a few different tomatoes.
Okay.
It's caused by a lack of calcium. There's typically enough calcium in the soil, but when you have uneven moisture supplies, sometimes they're not able to absorb enough calcium, the plants, and so they end up with a calcium deficiency in the fruit. And for that reason, then the bottom portion, the blossom end, turns kind of a dark brown or black and begins to rot. The best way to prevent that is to water during dry periods so the plants have an even moisture supply so they're able to absorb the calcium with the moisture. As far as sprays, no effective sprays on that.
All right, Carol, thanks a lot for your call. And let's try to squeeze this in. This is from Beth. I have ferns in front of my house. I want to transplant them to the slope between my neighbor and I to prevent erosion. First of all, would that work? And second of all, can I transplant them now? And if not, when?
Well, you can transplant some of the ferns. I would say either in the spring, just as you're starting to see the fronds coming up out of the ground would be a good time, or possibly in early fall, like maybe mid to late September.
All right. And do you think they'd be effective for erosion control?
I think they would. Things like ostrich fern spread quite vigorously, yes.
All right. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Donald Lewis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical assistance today from Jason Burns. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.